to season 4 of the podcast. I'm your host, Amanda Blackwood. If you've never listened to my podcast before, then welcome to you, and please hit that subscribe button. It's hugely beneficial to us podcasters. As many of you know, I wrote my autobiography as a survivor of human trafficking called Custom Justice, but if you didn't know, you do now. Keeping in line with that, this entire season has been focused on interviewing other people who did or plan to write about their own experiences as trauma survivors and how they overcame their past. As much as we all hate commercials, they are a necessary evil these days. That's what keeps the show on the air. You can also show support by purchasing one of my many books, or donating through PayPal, or leaving a review on whatever platform you listen to this podcast on. You can find the links for the books or donation options in the podcast description, of course, as well as the links to the guest. As of always, a portion of the proceeds from this podcast do go to local organizations that help fight human trafficking. Hey folks, welcome back to the podcast. As always, I'm your host, Amanda Blackwood. I have with me today a pretty amazing guest who's overcome a lot of stuff. I'm going to have him tell you that story because he's going to do a better job of it than I will. His name is Dallas Goodlett, and he's coming to us from Colorado Springs right now. Dallas, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, Amanda. Thanks for asking. How are you?
Fantastic. And I'm excited to actually have you on my show. I know we tried to record previously and there was a lot of stuff going on. But we're finally together. We finally get a chance to do this. And this is awesome. Dallas, can you tell me, where did you grow up? Where are you originally from?
So Kansas City, Missouri. Well, I grew up in a small town called New Market, Missouri. It was actually considered a village because we didn't have our own zip code. So we had probably about 60 people in the town, but it's a small town. It's about 30 minutes north of Kansas City, Missouri. So obviously most people have heard of Kansas City. So I kind of just tell them that's where I'm from, is Kansas City, Missouri.
Yeah, that seems like it might be a lot easier, huh?
Right.
Yeah, I know what it's like being from a small town. I once lived in a town of 162 people.
Yeah.
Pretty tiny.
Yeah, the town over next to us, it only had 350 people. So we had to use their zip code. But yeah, the town I grew up in had like less than 100 people, so it's small.
Wow. So what was the major catalyst of the trauma that you had to deal with that kind of sent you on this road that you've been on ever since?
The major catalyst, I would say, can you define that? Like,
what was the trauma that you had to overcome?
The major trauma I had to overcome was just being adopted. That was the very traumatic in itself, just not knowing who my biological family was. But I would say more of the major trauma was when I was 19 years old and found out who I believe were my biological family this entire time. They in fact were not. So yeah, just being adopted was hard enough, but being at age 19 when I found out everything that I thought I knew, I didn't know. That was the major point in my life that really, you know, was very, very traumatic that I had to get over.
Wow.
That age really sent me into a spiral of, you know, drugs and alcohol addiction and really just no value in my life. So yeah, like I say, it was hard enough being adopted, but knowing that at 19, hard.
I bet. I mean, that doesn't sound like that would be really a fun conversation to have with anybody. Did you find out from your adopted family or did you find out through your own research?
Well, no, it was kind of a Freudian slip almost from my dad. So I was kind of cool background when I kind of break my life up into chapters, like 5 chapters. And I tell people chapter 1 was I was 5 years old. My mom tells me at that time that I was adopted. And she didn't really get into a whole lot of specifics, and I'll tell you about that later why she didn't. But at 5 years old, she just explains that I'm adopted. She explained who the family was that they adopted me from. And this family, they only lived about 10 miles away. So I grew up playing sports. I wrestled, and I would see this family at wrestling tournaments. I saw who I believed were my biological mom and dad, I saw who I believed were my biological brothers. So I at least felt like growing up, I at least had that closure of knowing. So they didn't get into specifics. So from like 5 to 19, I just, you know, got in a lot of trouble at school. I never really felt like I belonged anywhere. I felt like, you know, my own biological parents didn't want me. Who does want me? Nobody does. You know, they gave me up. You know, why you, as a kid, you just don't understand why somebody would do that to you.
Right.
So yeah, that was just a very hard time in my life. And then at 19 is when I was working at a Kmart at that time, and I'll never forget it. It was imprinted in my brain, but I was working in the garden section of a Kmart. If people are older, they remember Kmarts. I was working at a Kmart, and who I thought was my biological mom had came in that day to talk to me and gave me her phone number. I had severe anger problems growing up. And I saw her, I took the number respectively. And I just said, sure, you know, I'll get a hold of you at some point, with no intentions of ever getting hold of her. So I took the number, put it in my pocket. And that day I went home and I was talking to my dad, and her name was Beth. And I looked at my dad and I said, you know, Beth came into the store today, Dad. She gave me her number. And I just, you know, I don't know why she does this. I don't want to talk to her. And my dad looked at me and he said, you know, Dallas, that's not your biological mom. And the way I explain that to people is, like, if you ever see like a war movie and like a landmine goes off and it's like slow motion and the person's like disoriented, that's like how I felt my inner being was, my identity, like anything I knew that I even thought I knew, it just exploded. I mean, my mind just, it just blew up. And so I looked at him. I mean, I just had this, just state of confusion. Like, what do you mean? What are you talking about? So from like 19 to about 24, I mean, I just went crazy with the drugs and the drink, and it's just self-destructive behavior as you can get. So later on in life, though, to kind of circle back to all this, my parents, who raised me from the time I was about 3 months old, they told me that when they went to the courts to adopt me, they had a counselor and a psychologist or therapist or whatnot, and they were advised to not get into details with your child unless your child brings it up. Well, there's a problem there, because anybody that's adopted has this immense feeling of shame, and it's really embarrassing. Because I mean, again, if you have a significant other and they dump you, you have this like, why'd you dump me? I mean, am I not good enough? Well, imagine your parents doing that. So right. When your parents do it, you don't even want to talk about it. I mean, I never wanted to even bring up being adopted. I mean, I would go into extreme fits of anger. Like if somebody brought it up at my school, I mean, it'd be an instant fight. I did not want to talk about it. So they advised the parents who adopt the kids, they advise them never bring it up unless your child asks. So I didn't know that for a long time, because I never want to talk about it. So from like 19 to 24, again, I just went on a complete self-destructive path. And it wasn't until later where I opened up and talked to my parents, and they explained to me that was the case. So for about 5 years, I took it as they just lied to me. You know, how could you lie to me? Why would you do that to me? And it was all about perspective at that time, because at that time it was all about me. I was being selfish. How could you do that to me, when I didn't look at it from another point of view and see, you know, maybe they were doing their best. Maybe that's what they were advised. But yeah, for 5 years, it was just total selfish, self-destructive behavior.
Wow. When you finally came out of the self-destructive behavior, were you able to salvage the relationship that you had with your adopted family?
Yes, completely. I'm 41 now, and 24 is when my life changed. We can talk about that later, but yeah, I took a substance where it changed my complete outlook on everything. And we haven't even gotten I don't think we've even really argued in 16 years. And before that, I mean, not even an argument. And I would say before that, they would say something. And I mean, like my room in my house where I lived with them, we had to do patchwork every other month, because they would say something and I would come home and just literally punch a hole right in the wall. I mean, I was surprised I didn't kill somebody growing up, because I just had such just anger, just deep seated anger. So yeah, since then, it's a whole new world. Like I said, we haven't even really argued since then. So
wow.
Yeah, that relationship is completely healed and perfect now.
And what you did for healing is a little controversial, and we'll get into that in just a moment, but were your family really supportive of you taking that particular route?
How I healed myself?
Yeah.
They don't know.
Okay.
And yeah, they don't know, because I grew up in a very, and this is another thing, like I'm thankful for, I grew up in a very, they weren't like religious fanatics, but I went to church every week. I grew up in a Christian church, you know, with the teachings of Jesus. And some of those things I've always kept near and dear to my heart as I always grew, you know, treat others how you want to be treated, forgiveness. So those things I was very blessed and fortunate to grow up with. But they, I don't know how they would handle that because their perspective on drugs and alcohol, it's just not favorable. So, I mean, even with cannabis right now, they're now just starting to learn that it has medicinal benefits. But for the longest time, it was, you know, kind of that reefer madness type mentality. So, you know, you smoke cannabis, you're going to go crazy and jump off a building, which, you know, that's not even remotely true. I don't. So, yeah, they don't have any idea. But I'll tell you, though, it's becoming a little more mainstream now. But like when I did this, it was like I say, 16 years ago, it was not even talked about. But now with where the world's heading, it's getting a little bit to be more culturally acceptable. So I think I will in the future. I don't have a problem with it, but no, I mean, if I would have told them 10 years ago, they would probably look at me like I was insane. So, yeah, not yet.
All right. So if Dallas's mom and dad are listening to this episode, this is a good time to turn it off. Dallas, what did you do to recover from everything that you'd been through? What helped you?
I would say there was a multitude of things, but I would say the most defining, the most impactful, the most, I would say just time crunching thing to get through something was psilocybin mushrooms. And I took a pretty massive dose. Now I had taken psilocybin several times before this, but this was one of the times where it changed everything. Again, I was 24, heavily into cocaine, alcohol, marijuana from the time I woke up, from the time I went to bed. And just it changed my perspective on everything. It changed the way I looked at people's intentions, forgiveness. And a major thing was forgiving myself, because you blame yourself a lot when you're adopted too. It's like, again, why did I do something to cause this? And I know it sounds crazy, but when you're 2 months old, I mean, you're a baby. So
what could you have done?
What's that?
What could you have done?
Yes, exactly. But your logical brain doesn't think that. I was running my life based on emotions, and there's just no logic involved. So again, logically speaking, I'm 2 months old. I'm like any other baby. What do I do to deserve this? But you're not thinking in that mindset at that time. It's just, there's no logic. It's just all emotion based. So forgiving myself was a huge one. And another thing too, for anybody out there struggling with substance abuse, when you get caught in the cycle of doing drugs and alcohol, you do a lot of things that you wouldn't normally do in a sober state of mind. And sometimes you keep drinking or doing drugs to forget about things you've done. So I did a lot of unspeakable acts when I was under the influence of drugs or alcohol that I would try to forget about and just do more drugs and alcohol. And it's a horrible cycle. I can never forgive myself. So when I did the psilocybin, it was just pure love, love and acceptance. And again, giving people the benefit of the doubt and looking at people's true intentions. Because before that, again, it was blame. It was all, how could you do this to me? And everything is about me, me, me. And after that, it was, you know, let me look at it from your point of view. And then let me also look at, even though I was adopted and I went through all these things, that was no excuse for how I acted and how I thought and behaved. So it was a lot of accountability, a lot of responsibility I took. And anybody that's taken psychedelics, it can be very scary because you're basically holding a mirror up to your soul, is how I looked at it. And it was dark. There was a lot of dark things that I had to face. And it was, I just cleansed myself that day. So I tell people I went through about 20 years of therapy in like 4 hours. So I did. I cried. I had moments of just every emotion I could think of. It was just like I tell people too, it's like having a sink filter. Like you put a filter in your sink and it gets clogged up with like food and debris and all that. It was like I took that filter and just washed everything away and it was clean again. And now I could just have all these emotions pass through there in a clean manner rather than be clogged up with, you know, all these things that were inside of me internally. So it changed everything very, very rapidly. And everything that was negative switched to a positive. And I've never been the same since then, in a good way.
Now, is this something that people can do under the watchful eye of a physician if they choose to?
I would highly recommend. I've also heard of people having, you know, and I had plenty of what you call a bad trip, but some people, I mean, I just saw a story the other day where a guy went to a festival in, I think, Washington State, and was on mushrooms and shot and killed like three people and shot a girlfriend. Well, because he thought the world was ending. And I read that article, and metaphorically speaking, your world is ending because you're not the same person after you do these. So you have to be careful and know that you're under the influence of a very strong, strong substance, and also understand that you'll come out on the other end. But that's like ego death. So when that guy shot and killed these people and he thought the world was ending, and that was it, his world was ending. His ego was dissolving right before his eyes. And for some people, that could be too much to take. So I think if people take that in a supervised setting, it's completely life-changing. It could change the world. But you really have to be very, very careful not to take those, especially if you have deep, dark demons. I mean, because they're gonna come to the surface. You can't escape it. So, yeah. But yeah, it can be very healing. And that has decriminalized mushrooms now. And then Oregon is another state. So but yeah, if you had a supervised setting, it's completely healing and transformative. You just have to be very careful of your set and setting is what they call it.
Yeah. And I know they've been around forever. I mean, this is a naturally existing substance, kind of like marijuana. Back in the 1950s, there were experiments done with mental health with LSD, which is similar in the fact that it is a mind-altering substance that can have a hallucinogenic effect. And somebody very famous back in the 1950s underwent this therapy and was a huge proponent of it. His name was Cary Grant. Mm-hmm. Cary Grant had the same kind of abandonment issues from childhood, ran away and joined a circus, and had to deal with his own demons for a long time in his life. I think there's something to the, you know, finding out how these substances can alter your perspective and change your life in significant ways under the watchful eye of the physician, like we were saying. And I think you're right. I think Colorado is one of the few states that has decriminalized it, but I would still be, you know, right on board with you saying it's best to do this under a physician's watch, because it can be frightening and dangerous to go through something like this alone.
Yes. And that's, I've told people, like, I've seen heaven and I've seen hell on psychedelics. Like, I've been in a state where, to me, that's what heaven's going to be like when I'm high. There's nothing but, like, money doesn't matter, sex doesn't matter, food, like, all these things that we define ourselves as humans and these needs, they don't matter. It's just, it's pure love. Like, I was blanketed, like, in a warm glow and just of love. And that's what I felt God was like. And then I've also had it the opposite end where I was in straight up hell. Like, if there's a hell, I was in it. And it was just lonely, cold, depressing, dark. It's hell. And if you don't know how to navigate your way out of that and just kind of hold on for the ride, I mean, you might end up killing yourself. So yeah, I would never recommend anybody just go do because it's life-changing, you know? So, yeah. And it could be life-changing in a good or bad way. Like I say, that guy shot and killed people because he went crazy. So, and if that guy would have taken those in a supervised setting, it'd probably been way different, but he didn't, and now his life has changed, and obviously other people's are for the worse.
Yeah. And how did the physical exercise play a role in your life?
Yeah, so that was another thing I would recommend to anybody is this is safe for anybody to do. So I say the other major thing that really helped me get over the drug and alcohol and just my mental state was, of all things, it was walking extremely long distances. And I'm not talking walking like a mile or two and going back home. I'm talking 5 miles, 10 miles a day. I've walked over 30 miles in one day before. And when you do that, there's a couple things that helps with this. Number one, you're abstaining from the substance and you can't even do it. So like cigarettes, I was hooked on nicotine for over 20 years. I smoked over a pack of cigarettes a day for 20 years. Cocaine was another one, and alcohol. When you go on these long, the only discipline you have is, like, for cigarettes, that was the first thing I quit when I went walking. And I knew, I'm like, if I could just leave my house and get away for 5 or 6 hours a day and go walk, I can't smoke. And so the only discipline I have to have is I don't, you know, pick a nasty cigarette butt off the ground and smoke that, which I, you know, I wouldn't do that. So I'm thinking if I can just leave the house and go walk and get out in nature, get out in fresh air, clear my mind out, I won't smoke anymore. So I did that probably a month, and then just all desires for cigarettes, it was just gone. I mean, I could breathe better. And again, it was the biggest thing was getting away from that substance. You know, when we're sitting in our house and there's drugs around you or alcohol or whatever, you're human. You know, don't beat yourself up. You're probably going to end up giving in and doing those substances. But if you can just get away from them, you're going to increase your likelihood of not giving in to those substances, I mean, tenfold. So walking was transformative. I mean, it was, I wouldn't say it was as massive as impact of psilocybin, but it was very, very close.
You know, wow.
Very, very close. And like just even today, I'm not going to lie, we moved back from Florida to Colorado, and I wasn't really wanting to move to Colorado back. It's a beautiful state, but I fell in love with Florida, the sunshine, the warm weather all year. And being somebody that was still smoking cannabis all the time, it was just good for me to get out and get away from all that stuff. So when we moved back here, I was a little bit worried about falling into old habits. And just now, I got out and I went for a 5-mile walk, and there's no desire. Like, I was sitting here itching in my house, like, I don't want to smoke weed. There's cannabis stores here everywhere. I can just walk down the store and get some. But I was like, I'm not going to do it. So I went out for a 5-mile walk, and this desire is just, it's completely gone. So I tell people not only the physical benefits you get from walking, which is great. I mean, you'll lose weight, you'll get in shape, but go for a walk for your mental state, and especially if you're having a trouble with any type of addiction, even food. Like, my weight has always fluctuated my whole life. I'll gain weight, I'll lose weight. But when I start going for, again, I get that craving, I get that urge, I just go for a walk. And the other beautiful thing about a walk is it limits your choices. So when you go out for a walk, there's no, you know, unless you get an Uber, you have to walk home. So like what I like doing is I walk for 4 or 5 miles, and then there's like, I have to walk home. And then all the message you get when you're out on walks, it's just such good for your mental state. And, you know, like any other challenges you have in life, it's just one step at a time. It's not, you're not trying to rush. You're not trying to sprint to your, on your walks. You're taking one step at a time, and eventually you'll get to that destination. So there's a lot of messages you can get on long walks. And again, I just tell people, don't go for a mile or two. Like, it's about 3 hours. It's about a 10-mile walk. And when you walk 10 miles, you feel like you almost feel like you went on vacation, you know, mentally. You're just so, all your thoughts are just kind of, you know, like I tell people real quick is like, you go outside, you look at your garage and you have a hose and it's all tied up into 50 knots. You look at it and you're like, I don't even know where to begin. And a lot of times that's what people's lives can be like. That's what my life was like, you know, with all these addictions. And when you go out for a walk, it's like untangling that hose, and now it's like linear. So it can really help. That's, again, it helped me out. And I would say it's probably, psychedelic mushrooms, my daughter being born, and long walks were the three things that it changed everything in my life.
Wow. Speaking of your daughter, when I originally had you fill out my questions, one of my questions was, who inspires you the most and why? And you answered your daughter. How old is she now?
She's 9. She'll be 10 August 8th.
Oh, my goodness. Another August baby. My son was born in August.
Oh, really? What day?
August 31st of 2000. So he's a grown man now with a baby of his own.
Oh, well, congratulations on that.
Thank you. So why do you find her so inspiring?
Well, I'll try to make it quick here about her. So when she was born, I was a full blown alcoholic at that time. I'm still doing cocaine still, but alcohol was, I was full blown alcoholic at that time. And when she was born, I knew I couldn't get away with being a drunk dad. Now, I still smoke pot every day. But I was a high functioning cannabis user. A lot of people didn't know I was smoking weed. I'd work every day, but the alcohol had to go. So when she was born, she was also my first blood that I ever knew, you know? So I didn't know.
Oh, yeah.
It was, children are life changing as it was, but when she was my only blood that I ever knew or had, it was like, she was extra special to me. So I always wanted to be a father, obviously, since I was, you know, grow up or die, I always wanted my own family. So when she was born, and it was kind of weird too, like I almost secretly hoped I had a daughter. I didn't have any other goals in life at that time other than to be a good dad. So when she was born, right, that was my only blood, drinking. And since she's been born, I've been drunk twice in 10 years. I don't drink at all anymore. but in 10 years I've been like intoxicated twice, and she fortunately didn't see me drunk either time. I would socially drink here and there, but now, like I say, I'm completely sober. I don't do anything anymore.
Wow.
But yeah, she just inspired me too, because she's such a strong kid. Like, she's so resilient, and I look at her, I mean, I just admire the hell out of her. She's just such a strong, strong kid. She's been through a lot. She's moved several times with us. Our, you know, mom and dad are crazy. We're wanting to move all the time, and she hasn't grown up around her cousins and grandparents as much as I had hoped. So, and she switched schools a couple of times, but she's just tough as nails. And, you know, but I teach her that stuff too about your perspective. You know, it could be, I'm always teaching her life could be way worse. You could be some other kid that getting beat every day. And again, you get to live by beautiful beaches and beautiful mountains here in Colorado. So she takes those lessons and applies them to her own life. So seriously, she's stronger than most adults I'm around. So, yeah, she's a big influence in my life. I learned from her. So
that's pretty cool.
Love her to pieces.
There's something amazing about those kids, man. The ones that inspire us to be better people. They're just such special kids.
Right.
Yeah. And the other one that you had listed was a name that I'm not familiar with. Wes Watson. Who's Wes Watson? What's he mean to you?
He's the one that got me to really get sober completely. He's people can look him up, and he may not be everybody's cup of tea, but I grew up with more, I almost need that militant type dad in my lifestyle. Somebody that's like real in your face about things, because to me, that's the only way I would ever change, is I need somebody to get in my face and like get real with me. So Wes Watson was a guy, he was in prison for 10 years. And his story is just crazy, because he was in prison for 10 years. He was in solitary confinement for like 2 years, where, you know, you're in your cell for 23 hours a day. You don't even see people. So a lot of times that makes people go crazy in itself. And, you know, you get out and you're a felon. Most people you fall into that trap again, and your life is ruined when you get out of prison. So he turned his life around. He's big on Instagram, on YouTube, and just his message, he's changed so many men's lives, because he's turning men into men again, like good fathers, good husbands. And one of the biggest things about him was he talks about sobriety, and he talks about how, and he's tatted up. I mean, he's got I mean, you wouldn't think this guy's sober, but he works out all the time. He's sober. And I needed somebody to influence me to live that sober lifestyle, because even people like, I use somebody like for The Rock example, The Rock, the actor, he's big, works out, but he sells tequila. He shows him on Instagram drinking tequila. And while that may be all fine and dandy for him, and I'm not saying he needs to be responsible for other kids, but some kid's going to see that. And I hate saying this, but he just probably ruined some kid's life, because some kid's going to see that and think it's okay to drink tequila while he's working out. And he probably just turned some kid into an alcoholic. Now, again, is that his responsibility to change every? No, it's not. But I'm looking to find somebody who can live that lifestyle, but also remain sober. And that's just something he talks about. And he doesn't shove it down your face, but he talks about, you know, if you have a clear mind and you're sober and you don't take any back steps, it's just a matter of time before you're killing it in life. You know, you're just wins all around. So he's just somebody that, again, went through, I mean, his story is just, it's crazy just what he went through. And then, like, when you listen to him talk, he doesn't miss a beat. He's just so inspiring. So, but again, like I say, some people, I hear, like, he yells a lot and he screams. Well, some people need to hear that, you know, so he got through to me. So, yeah, the first time I ever heard him was I was in Colorado out, you know, smoking pot everywhere, out walking. And, I heard him on YouTube. And I was like, huh, he hit me. So, yeah, he changes a lot of people's lives, especially, like I say, you know, grown men, they're going through alcohol or drug addiction or whatever. He's very inspiring. So anybody out there, just look him up.
Very cool. Dallas, I've got one last question that I always ask people before I let them go. And it's my favorite question of the episode, always. And it's all right if you need a moment to think, because most people do. What is one thing that you love about yourself that's not related to your physical appearance?
My mental toughness. That's what I love about it. It's something I love about myself, because, again, I know people have had it way worse than me. I'm not saying they haven't, but I feel like what I've been through, and I'm continuing to grow. There is no ceiling for me. So every day I try to get better. Just my mental, I'd say, yeah, for sure, my mental toughness. But again, I can always be mentally tougher. But as I say, I'm trying to work on things every day. But just from where I've came and where I'm at right now.
Awesome. Well, I do have a link to your Instagram, the_walk_king. I'm going to make sure I put that in the show notes so that people can follow you on Instagram and keep up with your story and get to know more about you. Do you have any parting words that you would like to leave somebody with?
Yeah, I would say just don't ever give up. Don't ever quit. I have another saying, slow motion is better than no motion. And that's, again, something when you're out walking, you just take one step at a time. You know, believe, work out, you do the right things. And, you know, it may take a year, may take 2 years, may take 5 years, who knows. But you'll eventually reach that. And it's, you know, if you're struggling out there with drugs or alcohol or depression, even if it takes 5 years, that's going to be a hell of a lot better than what you're, you know, where you will be at in 5 years if you don't change. So just, yeah, don't quit. Don't give up.
Awesome. Thank you so much for joining me today, Dallas. I really appreciate you I love your journey.
Well, thank you. Appreciate it. Hope somebody hears it. And I know it's kind of cliche to say, but yeah, if one person can change, then I'll feel way better about myself.
If you've enjoyed tonight's episode, please make sure you check out the episode description. There you'll find links on how you can learn more about this guest, links to connect with them on social media, and how to support the podcast. Remember, I don't get paid to do this. My boss is a bit tight-fisted. I can say that. I work for myself. In short, this show really is all about the guest. If you've enjoyed their interview, please feel free to let them know. You can also tune in to my other podcast, Growth from Darkness, which is co-hosted by a lovely lady from Australia. We talk about what trauma responses are and healthy ways to move beyond the past. For more information, just go to growthfromdarkness.com. You can also follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/growthfromdarkness.